France took in 400,000 Russian refugees in the 1920s, more than four times as many as any other country. Many other immigrants came from Poland, Italy, Armenia, and Algeria. In older industries, wage levels told a different story. By far the biggest strike of the mid-1920s, the general strike in Britain, between 3rd and the 13th of May 1926, arose from the attempt, successful as it turned out, by employers to reduce wages in a coal industry suffering from serious overcapacity. Over 1.5 million workers from various branches of transport and industry came out on strike in support of about 800,000 miners, locked out by their employers. Attempts to break the strike gathered momentum, and within 10 days the Trades Union Congress, TUC, called off the dispute, accepting government terms that were little less than humiliating. The miners continued their defiance, but were eventually driven back to work after 6 months, impoverished, completely defeated, and forced to accept the longer hours and lower wages imposed by the mine owners. German employers took an equally aggressive stance in November 1928, when they locked out the entire workforce of the Ruhr iron and steel industry, around 220,000 workers, to enforce new wage rates in the teeth of a national arbitration award. These major conflicts were the most obvious signs of a weakening position of industrial workers, especially those in the older heavy industries, and their trade unions, and the corresponding increase in the bargaining strength and militancy of employers amid high rates of unemployment, and this even before the Great Depression. France, like Germany, was among the countries most advanced in adopting in large-scale industry the modern management methods pioneered in the USA by Frederick Winslow Taylor soon after the turn of the century, and the mass production techniques introduced into car manufacturing by Henry Ford in 1913. A consequence in Germany of the far-reaching rationalization of industrial production was that unemployment, which had remained low during the early 1920s, more than trebled in 1925 to 26 to over 2 million, 10% of the working population. Similar levels of unemployment weren't uncommon elsewhere in Europe. In countries where growth was slow, such as Denmark and Norway, unemployment reached 17 to 18%. It was high, too, in the older branches of heavy industry and textiles, which faced increased competition in world markets and where rapid expansion had led to overcapacity. Unemployment in Britain never fell below 1 million, even before the slump. Unemployment insurance, first introduced in 1911 under the National Insurance Act, was extended after the war to cover around 12 million British workers, though in practice only about 60% of the workforce. Women were included, though their weekly benefit payments were lower than those for men. Domestic servants, agricultural labourers and civil servants were excluded. The scheme headed off the worst, but it had been intended to cover short-term, not long-term structural unemployment. The insurance fund proved insufficient and had to be subsidised by the state out of taxation. In Germany, the problem was similar but worse. The safety net of unemployment insurance introduced in 1927, and a notable addition to the insurance scheme against illness, accident and old age, brought in under Bismarck in the 1880s, was already under strain by the time the Depression beset the economy, and became overwhelmed thereafter. In any case, less than half of the working population had a claim on unemployment relief. Although other parts of Europe had followed Britain's early lead and introduced systems of unemployment benefit, the proportion of the workforce covered was even smaller. If the boom was both limited and uneven in its effect on industrial parts of Europe, In the countryside, where most of Europe's population still lived, many peasants on small holdings barely providing subsistence hardly noticed a boom at all. Many farmers had done well out of the war, and the post-war inflation often allowed them to wipe out their debts. Low land prices at the end of the conflict enabled those who could afford it to add to their holdings. But agriculture soon faced harder times. Increased production in Europe, as post-war recovery gained ground, encountered markets already glutted through produce from non-European countries, whose output during the war had expanded to fill gaps and cover shortages. By the later 1920s, the Soviet policy to export grain in order to be able to import vitally needed industrial equipment added to the glut. The result was falling prices. International prices for agricultural products had by 1929 dropped by over a third compared with the years 1923 to 25. Countries in Eastern and Southern Europe, heavily dependent upon agricultural production, were particularly badly hit. Agriculture remained largely unmechanized. Post-war land reforms broke up many big estates, but created large numbers of small, less productive farms and fragmented holdings. Farm subsidies in Czechoslovakia and elsewhere helped to promote improvements, while a shift to dairy and livestock products enabled Baltic countries to increase their exports. But for most of those who made their living from the land, the problems were mounting long before the slump. Farm indebtedness grew alarmingly. Many producers were on the edge before the Depression tipped them into insolvency. Flight from the land into the squalid living conditions of overcrowded towns increased as the gap between urban and rural incomes widened, and as young people saw no future for themselves in the countryside. They could no longer emigrate in great numbers to the USA, once far stricter immigration controls had been introduced there in the early 1920s. But they moved within countries. In France alone, 600,000 people left their small holdings between 1921 and 1931 to try their luck in urban workshops and factories. For those living in the countryside, the later 1920s scarcely constituted a boom period. The Depression struck regions already blighted over much of Europe. The crisis before the crisis left a rural population already before the slump susceptible to political radicalization. Many landless laborers were attracted by communism. Peasants who possessed land, on the other hand, tended to find appeal in the gathering forces of the authoritarian right. Although the economy in most of Europe had recovered strongly in the second half of the 1920s, the underlying problems left the continent exposed to grave difficulties in the event of a downturn in fortune. Few were aware of them. There had been modest improvements in the standard of living for many people, certainly compared with the previous decade. Many, perhaps most people, felt they could look forward to still better times in the future. Optimistic voices, some cautious, others more heady, predominated over the prophets of doom. But optimism vanished practically overnight, as the drastic impact of the stock market crash in New York between the 24th and the 29th of October 1929 enveloped Europe. The alternative model. Even before the onset of the economic crisis, those who were prophesying the certain and imminent end of capitalism could turn with admiration and for inspiration to one country, the Soviet Union. Cushioned from the vagaries of the international economy, the model of the Soviet Union, a system of state socialism preparing the ground for the final goal of communism, a society without private property and freed from class divisions and inequalities, appeared to many to be the utopian hope for the future. There was an attractive alternative to the market economy, the Soviet Union seemed to show, a better model for society than the grossly unjust, economically outdated and inferior capitalist system. State planning, resting on ownership of the means of production, and autarky, economic self-sufficiency, appeared to point the way forward. Both ideas were gaining supporters across Europe. Within the Soviet Union, economic growth had indeed been impressive. If, from a low platform, the result of the upheavals of the First World War and Revolution, followed by the ravages of the Civil War, recovery had been remarkably swift. By 1927 to 28, both industry and agriculture had reached levels of output comparable to those of 1913. The new economic policy, the Soviet policy between 1921 and 1928, that gave peasants a vested interest in cultivation and offered them limited opportunities to profit from marketing their produce, had proved a success. But by 1927, the policy was creating its own problems, and industrially, the Soviet Union still lagged far behind the advanced countries of Western Europe. How to tackle the problem of economic backwardness had remained an issue of heated debate among the leadership. Overcoming this huge weakness was seen primarily as crucial to averting the threat from rapacious imperialist powers, but also to improving living standards as the basis of securing the future of socialism in the Soviet Union. These, it was taken as axiomatic, would at some point embroil the country in war. Either we do it or we shall be crushed, Stalin told the party's Central Committee in November 1928, at a vital economic and political turning point for the Soviet Union. But the path to this decisive moment was far from straightforward. After Lenin's death in January 1924, economic policy had increasingly become the central issue in the bitter internal political struggle that would end in Stalin's outright dominance and a huge, fateful shift in the direction of the Soviet economy. The new economic policy had been contested from the outset in 1921. Some prominent Bolsheviks, Trotsky more than any, had seen it as merely a temporary expedient to get over the worst and were soon pushing for increased state economic planning and more rapid industrialization at the expense of the peasantry. Trotsky also continued to insist upon the need to export Bolshevism and promote world revolution. Stalin, on the other hand, had announced in December 1924 that the party's goal had to be socialism in one country. By this time, Trotsky's influence was waning fast. Whatever the force of his arguments and his striking personality, he had made too many enemies. Moreover, his control over crucial levers of power within the party was weak. Stalin, backed by other leading figures, Grigory Zinoviev, Lev Kamenev, and the darling of the party, as Lenin had dubbed him, Nikolai Bukharin, was able to outmaneuver him. In 1925, Trotsky resigned as Commissar for War, and later in the year was removed from the Politburo. In 1927, he and his followers were expelled from the party for their heretical views, and the following year, Trotsky was sent into exile, 3,000 kilometers from Moscow. Lenin had warned on his deathbed that Stalin wasn't a fit personality to remain as the party's general secretary, the position he had held since 1922. But Stalin had ensured that the warning wasn't circulated and used his pivotal position at the heart of the party's organizational machine to engineer his own supremacy. Zinoviev and Kamenev made it easier for him. In 1926, they had reversed their former stance, joining Trotsky's opposition to what they viewed as an economic policy that was too favourable to the peasantry. In fact, steps towards comprehensive industrial planning had already been taken, though as yet without any official weakening of the new economic policy. Stalin, firmly backed at this stage by Bukharin, the leading advocate of the policy, was able to undermine, then oust from their positions of power, both Zinoviev and Kamenev. They too were expelled from the party in 1927, though, condemning Trotsky and recanting their opposition, they were readmitted, contrite and humbled the following year. Only Bukharin now stood in Stalin's way. Stalin, pressing for extensive requisitioning of food supplies and a harder line towards the peasantry, was now increasingly at loggerheads with his former ally Bukharin, who strongly favoured maintaining the new economic policy. By mid-1928, the two had become irreconcilable political enemies. Stalin was adamant that small-scale production posed an insuperable block to economic growth. It was essential to guarantee the provision of food for an expanding industrial population, and that could only be achieved through large-scale production run by the state. He moved deftly in winning support in the party for an ambitious plan to maximize rapid industrial growth at the expense of those in the countryside. Controlling the party's apparatus, he denigrated Bukharin as a deviationist. By 1929, Bukharin was yesterday's man. Stalin was the winner of the power struggles. The Soviet Union's supreme leader, finally unchallenged in claiming Lenin's mantle for himself. Already by then, the new economic policy, though not publicly disavowed, was obsolete. In the winter of 1927-28, peasants were hoarding grain rather than selling it at the official depressed price. Serious food shortages started to build up just at the time when major industrial projects had been set in motion. Middlemen, racketeers able to exploit the shortages, were buying up agricultural produce and selling it at black market prices. Stalin, the self-styled man of steel, he had been born Yosef Djugashvili, lived up to his sobriquet, and responded in characteristic fashion through brutal coercion. He journeyed to the Urals and Siberia in January 1928 and peremptorily requisitioned stocks of grain, much as had been done during the Civil War. Any opposition to what was dubbed the Ural-Siberian method received short shrift. Bukharin tried in vain to prevent the extension of the requisitioning and to head off Stalin's increasing hold on power. By the middle of 1928, Stalin had won the conflict over future economic policy. A draft program of rapid industrialization was put forward that year and accepted by the Party Congress in April 1929 as the first five-year plan. Much of the plan was in fact fairly chaotic in its implementation, and the targeted extraordinary increases in production were achieved only in fabricated official output figures. Even so, the advances were impressive, all the more so with the rest of industrialized Europe now slumping into the throes of a severe depression. Huge new industrial complexes sprang up. An enormous hydroelectric plant was established on the Lower Dnieper. Sprawling metallurgical factories were built at Magnitogorsk in the Urals and Kuznetsk in Siberia. And large-scale tractor manufacture expanded in Stalingrad and Kharkov. Peasants left the countryside in droves to join the swelling numbers of workers in industry, whose numbers doubled within 4 years. Industrial output grew, even by sceptical estimates, at over 10% a year, with roughly a doubling in the production of coal, oil, iron ore, and pig iron by 1932. The human price was, however, horrendous. a price that no country in the rest of Europe could have contemplated for a second. Working conditions, rates of pay and living standards of industrial workers were appalling. Discipline in factories was draconian, with severe punishment for slackers. But the five-year plan had far worse consequences for those in the countryside. The regime had recognised from the start that the industrial programme had to be pushed through on the backs of the peasantry. The failure to extract sufficient grain from the peasants to prevent shortages and rationing of bread in towns in 1929 prompted the adoption that year of a programme of forced collectivisation of agriculture. The intention was that within 2 years a quarter of the sown area would be held by collectives, big factory farms worked by a rural proletariat of peasants who had been deprived of their own holdings. In fact, collectivisation went ahead faster than this. Nearly 60% of the 25 million peasant households were collectivised already by March 1930. But the peasants didn't comply readily. Almost 750,000 took part in revolts, which broke out in several parts of the Soviet Union. We had grain and potato requisitions, and they took them from us by force, both from the poor peasants and from the middle peasants. Simply speaking, it was robbery, complained one smallholder, asking for the reversal of collectivization, pleading for freedom, and then we will be glad to help the state. The regime temporarily acknowledged the problem. Stalin blamed the excesses on local functionaries dizzy with success. The proportion of the peasantry in collectives fell back sharply to 23%. It was a brief lull. Pressure soon resumed. By the harvest of 1931, more than half of the households had once more been dragooned into collectives, which produced nearly all Soviet grain. 3 years later, and collectivization had triumphed almost everywhere. Enforcement was ruthlessly carried out by brigades of party zealots sent out from the towns. A policy of de-kulakization, liquidating the kulaks as a class, was proclaimed to encourage an assault on the supposed better-off peasants, accused of being rural capitalists. Kulak meant, however, whatever party activists wanted it to mean. Anyone resisting collectivization could be dubbed a kulak, and imprisoned, deported to a far-off labour camp, or simply shot. From Ukraine alone, as many as 113,637 kulaks were deported by force in the first months of 1930. Those voicing objections to the coerced collectivization, but plainly too poor to be kulaks, were dubbed sub-kulaks and subjected to the same punishment. Many kulaks fled, selling their property if they could, or simply abandoning it. Some killed their wives and children, then took their own lives. Grain production had been expected to double. In fact, it fell. Not drastically, though since state procurement of grain more than doubled, the rural population was left desperately short of food. And as the peasants were forced into collectives, they slaughtered their own cattle or left them to starve rather than surrender them to the state. The numbers of cattle and pigs fell by half, sheep and goats by two-thirds. Meat and milk were, as a result, also scarce. Collectives that hadn't met requisition targets were deprived of produce from elsewhere in the Soviet Union and ordered to hand over their seed corn, thereby guaranteeing a repeated harvest disaster the following summer. Famine, worse than in 1921-22, and a direct consequence of Soviet agricultural policy, was widespread in the terrible year of 1932-33. Kazakhstan and North Caucasus were among the areas worst affected. The impact was most terrible of all in Ukraine, which should have been a fertile crop-growing area. A party official entering one village was told, "We've eaten everything we could lay our hands on. Cats, dogs, field mice, birds, even the bark from the trees." Over 2,000 people were punished for cannibalism in 1932-33. The death toll from the famine in Ukraine can't be known with accuracy. The best estimates are around 3.3 million deaths from starvation or hunger-related diseases. For the whole of the Soviet Union, the figure can be nearly doubled. Some news of the horror trickled out, but admirers of the Soviet Union downplayed the stories that emerged or rejected them as anti-communist propaganda. Most people in Western Europe knew nothing of the famine. Few foreign observers were able to witness the disaster. One, the British journalist Malcolm Muggeridge, described it as one of the most monstrous crimes in history, so terrible that people in the future will scarcely be able to believe that it happened. He was right. The people on the eastern fringe of the European continent had suffered more than most even before the First World War. Then, in the post-war turmoil and the Russian Civil War, and now under the Soviet regime, the veil of tears was already deep, but the full depth of the abyss was yet to be plumbed. The Cultural Mirror. What sense did people in Europe make of the world they were living in, of the forces that were inexorably shaping their existence? A generalized answer is, of course, impossible. Patterns of life and the reflections they provoked depended on many variables. These included accidents of geography and family background, as well as social class, political culture, and the vagaries of historical development. Far-reaching reflective insights were in any case inevitably confined in the main to a well-educated elite, an elite with access to the higher levels of education denied to the overwhelming majority of the population. The most innovative talents in the creative arts both mirrored and shaped what in the broadest understanding could be described as the zeitgeist, or spirit, of the age. For those, mainly in the upper classes or the educated middle classes, who were used to imbibing the products of this high culture, important traits of social thought and artistic creativity could prove, if only indirectly, extremely influential. For much of the population, however, this high culture was inaccessible. It lay beyond the parameters of normal life. What remained for most people at the end of the working day or week were avenues of popular culture, entertainment films, dance halls, and, not least, for men at any rate, visits to the pub or bar, that offered not reflection on the world around them, but escapism and momentary excitement, temporary release from the drab, often depressing reality of daily life. Going to the cinema offered the greatest chance of escapism. New picture palaces shot up in Europe's towns and cities. Germany had more than anywhere, over 5,000 by 1930, double the number a decade earlier, with 2 million seats in total. Cinema attendance grew even more once talkies started to replay silent films towards the end of the 1920s. Cinemas provided what audiences wanted. Most films were comedies, dramas, adventure or romance. Professional sport, football especially, offered the other big escape for working men, though hardly at all for women. Football's popularity had extended from Britain to other European countries long before the First World War. Major leagues had been established in Germany, Italy, Spain, and elsewhere. Huge attendances were commonplace. In England, the first Wembley Cup final of 1923, when Bolton Wanderers beat West Ham United 2-0, had attracted a crowd officially put at 126,000, though usually thought to have been double that number.
My granddad, long before I was born, and his two elder sons were among the crowd. They travelled down 200 miles from Oldham together by train, but arrived back separately and on different days. Uncle Jimmy was found asleep in a railway siding at Reading 3 days after the match. The Kershaws had enjoyed themselves. High and popular culture rarely met. But in different ways, they were both central to the zeitgeist of interwar Europe. It wasn't merely a question of alternative forms of culture. The extremes of cultural creativity and artistic innovation that were reached in the first post-war decade were inevitably the taste of a small minority. Not only were avant-garde cultural forms too varied to be easily summarized, remote from the lives of most of the population, but where they were seen most acutely to challenge traditional culture and values, they faced hostile rejection. Belonging to the avant-garde meant attachment to the artistic ideals, forms, and expressions of cultural modernism. From about the beginning of the 20th century, though the ideas themselves went back 2 decades or so earlier, practically all branches of cultural creativity turned away from earlier classical, realist, and romantic forms of expression, and self-consciously embraced modernism. The diffuse, aesthetic concept of modernism covered a huge range of differing modes of artistic expression. What united them was the revolt against previous forms of representation, which they regarded as outmoded, superficial, devoid of inner meaning. The manifesto, presented in 1906 of the Dresden group of expressionist artists who called themselves Die Brücke, the name was meant to imply the bridge to a new artistic era, proclaimed that as young people who carry the future in us, we want to wrest freedom for our actions and our lives from the older, comfortably established forces. All that was conventional or bourgeois was rejected. It was replaced by boundless aesthetic experimentation with the new, the modern. It amounted to revolutionary destruction of the old in order to rebuild in completely new ways, according to artistic imagination and creativity. Earlier ideals of beauty, harmony, and reason were radically discarded in modernism. Fragmentation, disunity, and chaos were the new leitmotifs, a remarkable anticipation in cultural forms of the political and economic rupture left by the First World War. After the war, as before 1914, Paris was a magnet for cultural energy and creativity, a center of modernist vitality. Pablo Picasso, already famous as the creative force behind Cubism, new forms of three-dimensional abstract representation, who had made his home there before the war, was the most glittering star in the firmament. Artists from across the continent and beyond were drawn to the vibrancy of the French capital. So were modernist writers, including James Joyce, Ernest Hemingway, and Ezra Pound. Artistic innovation flourished on the left bank. Dadaism, created in Zurich in 1916, and Surrealism, originating in France the following year, the two closely related, most novel and revolutionary art forms, thrived in Paris in the 1920s. They had emerged chiefly in reaction to the bourgeois society that had produced the horror of the First World War, and extended from the visual arts to literature, theatre, film, and music. Rejecting reason and logic, both emphasized the absurd, the nonsensical, the illogical, and the irrational, depicting strange leaps of imagination. Direct or indirect stimulus came from the insights into psychoanalysis and the primal urges of the unconscious by Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung. Behind the superficial order of the world, experimental art aimed to show, lay inexplicable chaos. Beyond apparent coherence was absurdity, weird flights of fantasy of the hidden psyche. The intention was to shock the sensibilities, to stimulate the search for unknown possibilities of meaning. The forms of cultural modernism varied greatly and crossed the continent in different but overlapping ways during the 1920s. Russian constructivism and the Dutch De Stijl movements emphasized geometrical abstraction in design. Italian futurism, its pre-war heyday now past, used abstract painting to depict speed, dynamism, the triumph of technology. In writing, self-conscious modernism underlay James Joyce's Ulysses, the poetry of T.S. Eliot, most notably his epic 1922 composition, The Wasteland, and the novels of Virginia Woolf, a central figure in the London Bloomsbury Group. The second Viennese school gave its name to the experimental atonal music of Arnold Schoenberg, Alban Berg, and Anton Webern, which used fluid varieties of 12-tone constructions to break away from classical harmony. Whatever form modernism took, it was characterized by a rejection of conventional artistic realism. Fragmentation, irrationality, fragility, dissonance were its main features, and accorded with a post-war world in which certainties had dissolved. Even physics, following Albert Einstein's revolutionary discovery in 1905 of the theory of relativity, had lost its certainties. While Werner Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, introduced into quantum mechanics in 1927 and demonstrating that the position and speed of particles around a nucleus couldn't be known with precision, seemed to cement the view that rationality couldn't explain the world. All the features of modernism were present in avant-garde culture before the war, but the horrors of 1914 to 18 greatly accentuated the artistic assault on rationality. And from being the outsider movement before the war, modernism had now entered Europe's cultural mainstream, though its popular acceptance was another question altogether. Nowhere, not even Paris, eclipsed German linguistic and cultural innovations in modernist brilliance. Because of its lasting importance, it would be easy to exaggerate how representative Weimar culture, as the remarkable German cultural avant-garde of the era has become known, was in its time. Most cultural expression, even in Weimar Germany, remained conservative and conventional. The name, Weimar Republic, had been taken from the town in Thuringia, the traditional centre of German culture, closely associated with Goethe and Schiller, where the Constitutive Assembly had met in 1919. Only 5% of nearly 3,000 exhibits at the Munich Art Exhibition of 1930, for instance, were modern works. Nevertheless, Weimar Germany, whatever its political travails, and Berlin quite especially as its focal point, witnessed in a brief few years an extraordinary efflorescence of avant-garde cultural and intellectual creativity that has few parallels in history. And in Germany, perhaps more than anywhere, art and social thought matched closely the changing temper of the age as the explosion of creativity of the 1920s gave way to its violent rejection in the 1930s. The war brought no rupture in the German cultural avant-garde. Expressionism, which deliberately distorted form and deployed unusual combinations of striking colour to transcend superficial appearance and expose the feelings and anxieties that lay hidden within, had been the most vibrant and significant artistic style in the decade before the war. Some of its leading exponents, harboring utopian dreams, had even welcomed the war as a cathartic experience that would destroy the old bourgeois order. The first experiences of the fighting underscored the exhilaration. "I wish I could paint this noise," Max Beckmann had written in 1914. The euphoria was fleeting. By the end of the war, Beckmann, Ernst Ludwig Kirchner, and Oskar Kokoschka, all of whom had volunteered for military service, had been discharged from the army because of physical or psychological breakdowns. Auguste Macke and Franz Marc had been killed. Expressionism had outlasted the war, though it was already being overtaken both by Dadaism as a more overt form of social and cultural protest, and by a new realism that graphically represented the truthfulness of the horror of war and revolutionary violence. The idealistic exuberance of pre-war expressionism was shifting to a bleak pessimism about human nature. In March 1919, Beckmann completed his large painting, Die Nacht, The Night, a frightening depiction of street violence and political chaos entering the home. Otto Dix, an enthusiastic volunteer in 1914, sketched crippled war victims and, under Dadaist influence, surrounded them with collages of newspaper cuttings and banknotes as scattered fragments of reality. Anti-war feeling was most plainly politicized in Georg Gross's grotesque compositions of disfigured dead soldiers and war invalids, starving beggars and prostitutes soliciting at sordid city street corners, or gloating war profiteers, bloated industrialists, and self-satisfied militarists. By the mid-1920s, the dominant cultural trend seemed to mirror the more stable conditions that had taken hold in Germany. Preoccupation with the inner psyche, emotions and idealism that had characterized expressionism and its related forms, gave way to a search for clarity and order in aesthetic form, a new objectivity or new matter-of-factness, neue Sachlichkeit, which took its name from an artistic exhibition held in 1925 in Mannheim. Modernism was now adopted in practical design, architecture, painting, photography, music, and theatre. At Weimar, then Dessau, the Bauhaus founded by Walter Gropius in 1919 brought together artists, sculptors, architects, and graphic designers to create a novel style marked by rationality and functionality. Among the leading artists associated with the Bauhaus was Vasily Kandinsky, who before the war had been the dominant figure in the Munich-based Der Blaue Reiter, the Blue Rider, group of expressionists. Now, back from Russia, he had turned to brilliantly striking, more angular, abstract geometrical compositions. The Bauhaus had a practical, as well as an idealistic, artistic purpose. Gropius believed in harnessing technology to create new forms of rationally planned housing that would overcome social misery and class distinction. Cleanliness, comfort, and efficiency in the use of space were its hallmarks. Simplicity of style and beauty were indivisible in this utopian vision. It would be new objectivity in its most practical and socially valuable expression. One of the outstanding products of architectural innovation was the Weisenhof estate, built for an exhibition in Stuttgart in 1927. The 60 buildings, constructed by a team of outstanding architects, including Le Corbusier, under the direction of Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, epitomized a new, modernist style dominated by geometrical lines, unadorned facades, flat roofs and open-plan interiors. The machine age, modern technology and mass production found their artistic exploitation in the use of steel, glass and concrete. Form without ornament was the maxim. It was far from universally welcomed. Vehement opponents decried it as cultural Bolshevism. In fact, little of the avant-garde architecture and town planning had a direct impact upon the housing plight of German cities during the 1920s, even if architects were called upon to design apartment blocks in Berlin, Frankfurt, and elsewhere. However, much of the modern design, like the related Art Deco first created in France during the 1920s, was gradually to find its way into a variety of more commonplace usages in Germany and far beyond. The richness of literature and social thought in the German cultural sphere didn't completely or neatly fall within the categories of neo-expressionism and new objectivity, however broadly these terms are defined. Possibly the most influential German novel of the interwar years was among the finest works of one of Germany's most renowned authors, Thomas Mann, whose conservatism had gradually led to a rational, if not instinctive or emotional, commitment to the new German democracy. Der Zauberberg, The Magic Mountain, which Mann had actually begun writing before the war, appeared to great acclaim in 1924. He had interrupted its composition during the war before completing it more than a decade after starting it under the influence of humanity's capacity for self-destruction in the Great Conflagration, and in a form that bore little resemblance to its initial conception. The highly complex work is rich in symbolism, its main focus the sickness of bourgeois society. The rarefied setting of a tuberculosis sanitarium in the Swiss Alps offers a metaphor for a world that is sick and decaying. Two of the main characters, Settembrini and Naphta, represent the conflict between reason and frightening irrationality. The third, Castorp, torn between the two, seems finally to side with the values of the Enlightenment, only as a novel draws towards its close on an ambiguous note, to declare himself, "For the principle of unreason, the spirituel principle of disease, under whose aegis I had already in reality stood for a long time back." Unreason, in this case, a claustrophobic, threatening inexplicability of determining forces that held the individual in an iron cage and which he was incapable of combating, was at the centre of the mysterious, seemingly prophetic works of Franz Kafka, works that were less known in the 1920s than long after his death in 1924. The striking originality of the gaunt-looking, hollow-eyed and psychologically tormented Kafka is all the more extraordinary given his relative detachment from the main literary exponents of the German avant-garde, even if he was well acquainted with many of their productions. Kafka was no more able to foretell the future than anyone else, but his writing, modernist literature at its bleakest, seemed supremely able to capture the helplessness and total bewildered alienation of the individual in the face of modern social and bureaucratic mechanisms of power and repression. The brilliant German sociologist Max Weber had regarded bureaucratic power as the very essence of modernity, writing of the disenchantment of the world in a rationalized society, though one where disciplined reason would uphold freedom. In Kafka's hands, there was no room for such implicit optimism. Confronting a reality beyond the seemingly ordered facade of daily routine, Kafka depicts an unfathomable world of bureaucratic rules, orders, laws, and persecution in which all attempts to find a path through the labyrinth are met with closed doors and never lead out of the chaos to the craved distant goal of redemption. In The Trial, published in 1925 after Kafka's death, Josef K. is arrested on charges that are never explained and faced with a menacing, seemingly omnipresent, inescapable, though unseen, court. When he tries to protest his innocence, he's told, "That's the way guilty people talk." His protracted trial, though there are no formal proceedings, forces him to gradual acceptance of his guilt, ultimate submission, and eventually to acquiescence in his barbaric execution at the hands of two silent executioners in a lonely and desolate quarry. In The Castle, published in 1926, a land surveyor, arriving in a remote village on presumed orders from the never-to-be-seen castle owner, encounters unremitting hostility from a closed community, subservient to the undefined, though real in their own minds, authority of the nebulous castle. The outsider, increasingly and destructively obsessed with the castle's authority, comes up against a dense network of social control. This even rules out an approach to a perhaps purely imaginary high official to discover why the surveyor has been called to the castle that is forever out of his reach. Willing submission to incomprehensible regulation, in Kafka's work, offers what seems, though the extraordinarily complex writing is susceptible to varied interpretations, a preview into the totalitarian societies of the following decades. Astonishing though the output of high culture was in so many different fields and in numerous European countries during the 1920s, it nevertheless hardly touched the lives of most ordinary people in any direct fashion. German theatre provides a case in point. The flourishing of the theatre in the 1920s, even in small towns, thanks in good measure to generous public funding, largely made possible by the short-term loans coming from the USA, was a central element of the extraordinary Weimar culture. Most famously, Bertolt Brecht experimented with novel forms of theatrical presentation, partly through using montage, sparse settings, and disconnected scenes, to produce alienation from the action rather than identification with it, and thereby to stimulate a critique of capitalist society. But most theatre-going Germans avoided the experimental works of Brecht and other avant-garde creations. Experimental theatre comprised no more than 5% of the typical repertoire of the 1920s. Most theatre was conservative in character. Furthermore, most audiences wanted musicals, comedies, farces, and other light entertainment. In any case, regular theatre-goers were themselves a small minority of the population and largely, because of the cost, middle class. Most German workers, as a survey in 1934 indicated, never went to the theatre at all. Other media show a similar disjunction between high and popular culture. The spread of the gramophone, and still more so of the radio, meant that people didn't even need to leave home for entertainment, which was more often than not light in character. Young people especially were more likely to listen to ragtime, jazz, dance music, or popular songs that across the Atlantic than to Beethoven or Wagner, let alone Schoenberg or Webern. Reading patterns, too, often bypassed the modern literary classics. Books were still expensive enough to be bought largely by the better off. The network of public libraries was expanding, though how much this directly benefited the working class isn't clear. The educated bourgeoisie, a relatively large section of the German population, might rush to read, or at least talk knowingly about Thomas Mann's Der Sauberberg, but most German workers appear to have read little more than newspapers and magazines. British readers were more likely to devour the detective thrillers of Edgar Wallace and Agatha Christie, or enjoy the scrapes of P.G. Wodehouse's Jeeves and Wooster, than immerse themselves in the complexities of Virginia Woolf's modernist writing. The Parisian intelligentsia might excite themselves about André Breton's 1924 Manifeste du Surréalisme, Surrealist Manifesto, the latest works of Marc Chagall or Picasso, or Marcel Proust's extraordinary, not least for its length, seven-volume epic novel A la recherche du temps perdu, In Search of Lost Time. But it is unlikely that the passion was shared by the peasants deep in provincial France, or toiling workers in the big factories of the north. Even a sympathetic critic of Fritz Lang's dystopian vision of human enslavement to machines in his brilliant futuristic 1927 silent film Metropolis, saw it as a failure because it simply isn't like life, neither the life of yesterday nor of tomorrow. Rapidly growing cinema audiences wanted for the most part to laugh at Charlie Chaplin's silent film antics rather than ponder the meaning of life in thought-provoking artistic avant-garde masterpieces. The two spheres of high and popular culture, of art and entertainment, rarely coincided or overlapped. Avant-garde modernist culture may have seemed an irrelevance to most Europeans, something that they didn't encounter and which had no effect on their daily lives. Yet it had a massive significance just the same. Only a few years later, in 1933, the Nazi burning of books outlawed by the cultural and racial ideology of the regime and the frontal attack on degenerate art were to demonstrate this in the most brutal way possible. The Great Depression of the early 1930s had by then proved a cultural watershed. As the critique of all that was new, threatening, and modern swelled under the impact of the crisis, the assault on degenerate cultural forms became a powerful part of the armory of fascism. This reaction was most extreme in Germany, not least because the artistic experimentation there during the 1920s had been so radical. However, the appeal of the fascist right, not just in Germany, was culturally anchored not in the attempt to turn the clock back to some mythical traditional era, but to harness an image of traditional cultural values, in practice often much distorted, to the vision of an alternative utopian future. This vision was itself modern in its way, certainly in its exploitation of technological progress for political ends. But its version of modernity was one that utterly rejected the ideas of liberal pluralism, individualism, democracy and freedom, which had spread throughout Europe since the French Revolution of 1789. Central to the utopian vision of fascism was national rebirth through redemption from the decadent, diseased forms of modernity. This meant the ruthless expunging of the avant-garde artistic creativity of a pluralist society. A disjunction between avant-garde and popular culture is common to most societies. More ominous was a cultural pessimism, more pronounced in Germany's large educated bourgeoisie than anywhere else, though certainly not confined to that country alone, which condemned both strands as expressions of decadent, corrosive modernity and symptoms of national decline. Modern art forms offered plenty of targets at which conservatives could aim their fire, while the hedonism of Berlin society was a ready target for aggressive denunciation in staid middle-class homes, small-town café conversation, or at the local's table in a rural pub. Such decadence could be seen as a threat to the nation's moral and cultural fibre. Rejection of Americanism became shorthand for all the ills of modernity that the German middle classes felt they faced. Jazz was decried as Negro music, the product of an inferior civilization to that which had produced Bach and Beethoven, while the erotic rhythms of American dancing were considered a threat to the sexual morals of young girls. Their bobbed American hairstyle, said one cleric, was truly bereft of metaphysics. The debasement of culture seemed epitomized by Josephine Baker, an African-American singer and dancer from St. Louis, Missouri, who was taking Berlin by storm, as she had done Paris, with her exotic and erotic dancing, clad in little more than bunches of bananas. Hollywood films, attracting millions of viewers by the late 1920s, were said to be swallowing up not just individuals, but the personalities of whole peoples in their mediocrity. Mass-produced industrial goods considered a threat to traditional German crafts, and consumerism symbolized by the large department store that undermined the existence of small shops, were further manifestations of Americanism, which was understood as posing an assault on the cultural essence of the nation.